After Adam and Eve sent out from the garden, it's not very far in the book of Genesis until we run into sin again. The very next chapter in Genesis chapter 4 tells us that Adam and Eve had children. First one was a son, Cain, and then another named Abel. The story of Cain and Abel is well known to us. Cain is a tiller of the ground, and Abel is a keeper of flocks. In the course of time, each of them bring offerings to God from what they have produced. Cain brings from the fruit of the ground, and Abel brings from his herds. And then the story that follows after that is one in which there is one accepted by God and one not accepted by God, and there's frustration and anger and a warning from God and more sin and ultimately murder. And we're only in Genesis chapter 4. If the book of Genesis is really made into a movie, it won't be rated G, will it? It's too much violence and too much that's ugly about humanity. But these things are written for our learning. They're here to teach us something, and we need to pay close attention to what they have to teach us. And so I want to start tonight with this point. I want to suggest to you that one of the things that we learn from the Bible and already see in Genesis is that sin follows patterns. People have their own personal patterns of thought and behavior that repeatedly lead to the habits of sin. Whether it's gossip, or anger, and violence, maybe drunkenness or sexual sin, there are patterns of sin in the lives of people. Probably there are patterns that each of us has struggled with or maybe have just accepted and we need to struggle with. But there also are more universal patterns, things that we see over and over again where people choose one way of thinking and that leads to a certain action and then that action leads to more thinking along those lines and they're just patterns like that. The sin of Adam and Eve in the garden illustrates a pattern that we all know too well. They start with doubting or mistrusting what God has said. And then you fuel that with some selfish pride and some fleshly desire. And the next thing you know, sin has occurred and then shame. And then the great effort to keep that secret. And then when secrecy doesn't hold out, the sharing of blame and the finger pointing begin. And consequences follow. And don't miss this part of the pattern. God extends His steadfast love in the hope that we will once again trust in Him and be redeemed. That too is part of the pattern. In Genesis chapter 4, with the story of Cain and Abel, there is also a pattern. In fact, many, if not all, of the same elements are present there. And so we want to follow this story and see what we can learn from it. But I just want to point out that this time it's not just eating a forbidden fruit. This time in Genesis 4, the result will be murder. Even fratricide. Fraternity meaning brother, and aside meaning killing. And so the murder from one brother on another brother. In fact, the first person born into the world that we know of turns out to be a murderer. That's kind of discouraging, isn't it? But what we find at the end of the story is the encouragement that God extends His offer of forgiveness and care anyway. Sin follows patterns, and our goal tonight is to learn to see those, to challenge ourselves to stop and think about what pattern sin might have in our own lives and to see if we can overturn it. Let's read together from Genesis chapter 4, verses 1 through 16. Now Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. And the Lord said to Cain, Why are you angry, and why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Cain spoke to Abel, his brother. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" And he said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden, and I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." And the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. And Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Well, Cain is a farmer. Abel is a shepherd. Both are respectable professions. In fact, both of these fit in with God's commission to the human race when he first created them, when he said to fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion over all the animals. Well, filling the earth with crops, filling the earth with herds, and tending those is part of what God created them for. The Bible doesn't tell us why Cain and Abel decided to make an offering to God. This is part of worship in the Old Testament, but the law of Moses, as we will come to know it in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, hasn't been given yet, but this apparently is something that God had revealed to them would be a way to approach him. So we don't know what particulars they had or what instructions, but the Bible simply says, in the course of time, each brought an offering to God. Cain brought of the fruit of the ground, and Abel brought, for his part, he brought of the firstlings of the flock their fat portions, and God accepted Abel's. But for Cain, for his offering, God had no regard. Now, a good question is why? I think we can look at a few other passages and probably come up with the answer to that question, but it's tucked away for us here in the text, if you will. Why is one acceptable and the other not? At first, you might think that the problem with Cain's offering is that it's a vegetable or grain offering. And we're familiar with Abel's offering, bringing of his flocks, and he was a keeper of sheep. Sheep and goats and cows were all part of the animal sacrifices. They were clean animals and offered regularly, and we're familiar with that. We think about them bringing of the best of their flocks and herds. We know about the altar there in front of the tabernacle and later in front of the temple where the parts of the animal were placed and where they were turned into smoke and where the blood was poured out. We're familiar with the animal and blood sacrifices. But if you haven't read through that part of the Old Testament in a while, there also is a place for offerings that are brought from the fruit of the ground. And so, for example, there are three main feasts that the Israelites kept. Okay, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which happened at the Passover. And then there was a Feast of First Fruits that followed 7 weeks later. And then there was a Feast of Ingathering at the end of the harvest that followed a few weeks after that. So out of their three main feasts, two of them have to do with harvesting things from the field. But that second feast, that Feast of First Fruits, goes by a couple of other names, by the way, Feast of Weeks and also Pentecost. If you think about it, it was 7 weeks after Passover and then the next day. So it was 50 days after Passover and Penta. You think about a pentagon with five. Well, Pentecost represents 50. So it was 50 days after that. That feast was a time at which the specific offering that they brought was from what they had gathered in the first gatherings of their wheat harvest around the middle of the summer. So that was a part of their sacrificial system. Even more specifically, the offerings that people brought were not always all burned up on the altar. In fact, generally speaking, only a small portion of an animal or a grain offering was placed on the altar in order to be burned. The majority of what was brought was given as a gift to the priests. And they didn't till the field, and they didn't keep flocks and herds. They stored this up, and this was their food throughout the year. It's interesting to look at a description of this in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 3 and 4. "This shall be the priest's fair allotment from the people who offer sacrifices, whether bull or sheep. They must give to the priest the shoulder, the jowls, and the stomach. You must," we could add the word "also" here, "give them the best of your grain, new wine, and olive oil, as well as the best of your wool when you shear your flocks." So all of the resources that they are getting from tilling the soil and from keeping flocks, they are sharing also with the priest. It's an offering to God. A little bit of it is burned on the altar, and the rest of it is saved by the priest. There are three things mentioned here that come from the fruit of the ground. So there's the grain and the oil and the new wine. And so grapes and olives and wheat or barley or other grains are part of the produce of the ground, and these are things they're bringing. Point here is to illustrate the problem is not animal versus vegetable. Later on in the ordinances that God gives to Israel, both of these are equally acceptable. But I will point out, here, this says you must give them the best. We are familiar with the concept that the firstborn of the flock was dedicated to God, that would be part of their sacrifice, and then they brought animals at other times, and there was never to be a blemish in them when they brought those other than firstborn animals as well. And they were to bring to God the best. And that was always true, whether it was animal or plant that they were bringing. If we look back at the offering that is brought by Cain and Abel, I just want you to notice what the text says. It tells us again that Cain brought to the Lord of the fruit of the ground, no comment on its quality. And Abel, for his part, brought of the firstlings of his flock their fat portions. Nothing said about the quality of Abel's. Double emphasis given to the quality. Nothing said about the quality of Cain's, and a double emphasis given to the quality of Abel's. The problem is not that one is from plants and one is from animals. The problem lies elsewhere. In Hebrews chapter 11, this verse that you have probably read hundreds of times, I just want to point out, I think it makes the very point that seems to be implied in the verse that we were just looking at. By faith, Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain did. Throughout Hebrews chapter 11, we are told what faith motivated people to do. It motivated Noah to build an ark. It motivated Abraham to leave his home and his father's house and go into a far country. It motivated person after person in the Old Testament story to do things that people who did not have faith would not be willing to do. And in this case, faith motivated Abel to offer a better sacrifice than what Cain offered. Because God's regard goes out to Abel and not to Cain, Cain is very angry. Who's he angry with? Well, the most obvious thing is he's angry with his brother. He might be angry with God as well, but the clearest demonstration of that is that he is angry with his brother. The motivation for that simply is that God accepted what Abel offered, but he did not accept what Cain brought. The result of that is a profound negative reaction from Cain. We have a deep desire for love and acceptance. And whether we admit it or not, whether we've recognized it or not, having been made in the image of God, we have something within us that desires right relationship with God. We have a deep desire for acceptance from a lot of folks, but including from God. Cain doesn't feel that, doesn't have a sense. It's communicated to him somehow that he has not pleased God, and he is angry about this. And rather than thinking that he is the problem, he looks elsewhere. When we're not accepted by God, we are tempted to blame someone else, to look anywhere else other than in the mirror. This is part of the pattern of sin. We make a decision. We take a course of action. It turns out that it was motivated by selfishness or by foolishness, unthoughtfulness. It turns out it was wrong. It turns out it was sin. We're embarrassed by that. We're hurt by that. We fear that because we fear not being accepted by God. And we fundamentally want to do what's right. And then we have a choice. We can acknowledge our mistake and our sin. We can confess, I was wrong in doing it. I made the wrong decision. I was motivated by selfishness. I was not listening to what God said. And if we make that choice, great blessings will follow. There may still be consequences for our sin. There may still be disruption in our lives because of the choice that we've made. But if we make the decision to acknowledge that sin, very soon good things will follow. If, on the other hand, feeling that lack of acceptance, that disapproval, that hurt, that shame that goes along with that, if we then look to other people as the ones to blame, as the place for that to be solved, more trouble will follow. God graciously comes to Cain even after his unacceptable sacrifice, even while he is seething with anger. God graciously comes to him with a warning. I want to talk about the warning, but I don't want you to miss that here is one who has not done what is proper toward God, has not brought his best to God, who is frustrated and angry, and God still cares about him. God is not willing that any should perish. When a person commits sin, God wants to warn them, don't commit further sin. When they commit further sin, God wants to love them and forgive them and turn them away from even further sin. And if they go a third and a fourth and a hundredth step, God faithfully, as he so often did to the nation of Israel, comes back and says, if you will acknowledge your sin and turn back to me, we can start right now today for things to be better. But if you don't, if you are not willing, if you have made poor choices, if you have committed sin, if you have started down the wrong path, and frustrated, ashamed, embarrassed, unhappy, you continue down that path, then there's a warning. Sin is lurking at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. That word lurking there can be translated more than one way. It can be translated as lying, like when someone lies in wait for someone, they're hiding down in the grass or hiding behind the bushes, or crouching like a lion or a tiger, that lion crouches just as it's about to pounce. That's its recoil before springing. That's its charging up its tendons and muscles in order to pounce. And so the Lord warns Cain. What a loving thing to do. To reach out to someone who is so frustrated and angry and say, you need to think. You need to be really cautious here. I don't want you to get hurt further. Sin is crouching at the door. He goes on to say, if you do what is right, won't you be accepted? What a great question. You hear the saying going around, it's never too late to do the right thing. Well, that's true, isn't it? It's not too late for Cain to make things better. But there are plenty of ways that he can make things worse. Sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you. You must master it. Implied in that is that there's something you can do about this. You're not just at the mercy of sin and temptation. You can make a choice. If as you were leaving your house this evening to come to worship, Bible study, if you discovered through a neighbor's phone call or looking out the window or peeking out the door, if you discovered that something was crouching and waiting to do you harm when you went out the door, what would you do? Maybe there's a criminal there crouching. Maybe there's a coyote there crouching. Maybe there's a lion, but that's pretty unlikely unless the circus is in town. But there's something there crouching to do you harm. What would you do? Well, the first thing I'd do is shut the door and lock it and go get Kayla. And then I'd call somebody. Call the police. If it's really big, I'd call Anthony. And I would get some help. And if I just had to go out the door, I'd go out another door. If I had that kind of warning that something is crouching and it desires to eat you up. But how often have you ever received a warning and ignored it? How many times have you had that thought clear, quiet, but nevertheless true in your conscience, in your mind, and in your heart, I should not say what I'm about to say. But then you say what? I'm going to say it anyway. So maybe you even say that out loud sometimes. Pardon me for saying this, and it doesn't work that way. Or maybe after we say it, or in the middle we say, bless his heart. How often have you, before taking an action, thought, I shouldn't do this, and done it anyway? Or maybe even further back in the timeline, earlier in the story, you have recognized a pattern. Did we mention that sin follows patterns? You have recognized, wait a minute, I think I know what's going to happen here. I've been here before. I've been frustrated or angry or feeling unaccepted like this before, and I've had these same thoughts rolling around in my head about how I'm going to act, what I'm going to say, where I'm going to go, and what I'm going to do. And I can see that unfolding in front of me, and something is saying, don't go through that door. Don't take another step in that direction. Don't go down that street. What do you do when God's warning comes to you? Don't go through that door. You need to have a plan. If the problem is anger, you need to be thinking about counting to 10. If the problem is just wrath that you pour out when you get confronted with certain situations, you need to back up and ask yourself why the devil has a hold of you in that situation so much. You need to have a prayer that you pray, a song that you sing, a scripture that you say, a friend that you call, another direction that you go. When through the way that God created us, His warning comes to you, sin is about to pounce. Sometimes, the way you don't go through the door is you just stop talking. Sometimes the way that you don't go through the door is that you get up from where you are and you go with your mind and your body in another direction to a better place. Sometimes the way you don't go through the door is you say, I'd like to go home. Or if you just happen to have a personal communication device in your pocket, you punch out the words, come get me, to somebody. When the will of God comes to you through the Word, through a brother or sister, through your conscience, through whatever means, sin is about to pounce. Please be wiser than Cain, and don't walk through that door. Jesus had a lot to say about anger, and that's at the root of this issue. So I just want to remind you of a little bit of what he said in Matthew chapter 6, chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, verses 21 to 26. Jesus warns us. He says, you know, the Old Testament said, do not murder. I want to tell you, don't be angry. Because that's at the heart of it. And then he urged us, when we realize that we have a problem in a relationship, to fix it immediately. He gave the illustration. Now keep in mind, the temple was still operating at the time Jesus is speaking. And he said, if you go to make your offering, and there you're making your sacrifice, and there, while you're doing that, you remember that your brother has a problem with you, stop what you're doing. Set aside your offering. Go find your brother. Get that reconciled, and then come and make your offering to God. Why is he saying that? He is saying you cannot profit by letting these things go, letting them fester. You have to make peace. Living with anger, living with resentment, is absolutely a recipe for further sin. It will happen. Ephesians 4:26, be angry, but do not sin. I'm not sure you can keep from getting angry, but you can seek shortly thereafter to change the way you're thinking, and you can choose not to sin. That's one of the implications of God's words to Cain. Sin desires to rule over you, but you must master it. Implication, it's not in control. God punished Cain for his action. He was banished from the land of his birth. He had to raise his family elsewhere. But God also had compassion on him. Somehow God put a mark on him so that if anyone encountered him, they would not kill Cain. Interesting. That's what he deserved, isn't it? That'll be one of the principles of the law later on. Capital punishment is part of the law. But God here extends mercy to him. Now I have a lot of questions there. You know, what was the mark? I don't know. How did everyone get the news that God had protected Cain? Probably posted it online somewhere. I don't know. Probably told people. Where did Cain get his wife? I don't know. Maybe there was a Christian college where he went to live, and that's where he got her. So apparently none of those things are the point of those verses, right? We don't know. The Bible doesn't say. So we can just keep wondering about those. So why are we told about God's interaction with Cain pleading for his life, and God helping him by graciously answering that plea? What do we know? We know that in spite of the fact that Cain had made mistake on top of mistake and committed sins that could not be undone, he could still receive God's grace. God still cared about him. There is not a person on the planet, no matter who they are, what they've done, how long they've been on the wrong path, and how far gone they are, or how close to the end of life they are, there is not a person living on the planet to whom God would not extend love and mercy if they would turn to him in humility and respond to him in submissive faith. Sin has patterns. Does any of this look familiar? It starts with a mistrust of God and the fear that comes from that. You fuel that with a little selfishness, self-focus of pride, and sin will occur. When that occurs, we'll feel bad. We'll have divine disapproval. We will not even approve of ourselves, most likely, even though we may pretend to. But we'll know that what we've done is not acceptable, and then we'll be hurt. We wish we felt good like other people, so we'll be jealous of them. We'll be angry because we're afraid, and we'll start blaming other people, and that'll lead to more sin and more hurt and more consequences. But at any point in that process, we can choose a different path. I want to challenge you with the first bullet point. If we trusted in God more, we would sin less. Now, that's partly because we'd pay more attention to His Word, and we would honor Him more, and we would care about what's right more. That's half of the equation. But it's also because we would be more content. We would be more at peace. We would experience more joy in our thankfulness for the blessings of God, and we would be less worried about this or that scenario because we would have entrusted ourselves to the one who will make all things well. And we spend a great amount of energy in sin trying to feel good when the ultimate feel good is when we are fully entrusting ourselves to God who is good. That doesn't mean nothing hurts or that we're never disappointed, but it sure results in a lot less hurt and a lot less disappointment and a sense of peace at the end of the day, every day. This pattern is familiar because it's a pattern for Adam and Eve. It's a pattern for Cain and Abel. It's a pattern for Joseph's brothers. It's a pattern for Abraham. It's a pattern for Israel throughout the history of the Old Testament. And then it's a pattern for the disciples and for these scribes and Pharisees in the New Testament. And I had a friend once. This was a pattern for him too. Sin is crouching just outside the door. And it desires to master you and be the master of your ultimate fate. And God warns us, and He loves us, and He invites us to master it instead. Not by our own power, but by coming to Him in humble faith and submitting to Him. You have an opportunity tonight to break this pattern. You see, anywhere in here, if you stop and ask for prayer, things are going to be different. If you share your concerns, the next step won't be the same. If you confess your wrongdoing, you undermine all of that anger and pride and self-will. And it might be tonight that you have before you a door that you're considering stepping through, and you need some help to change course. It might be that you just recently went through some doors and found sin. You can be clean of that through the blood of Christ if you would put your faith in Him, be baptized into Him, commit to Him, and trust Him. You can be clean of that as a Christian if you confess your sin. God may be warning you through the very words of Genesis 4, verse 7. Why are you so angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. As we sing the song of encouragement, it's an opportunity for you to take a different course, perhaps. We invite you to come while we stand and sing together.